Think over there, blocks the video camera. So we're starting our Binyan HaBayit class, and we always have this problem that when we start a new semester, we have a lot of people continuing, and Baruch Hashem, we have a lot of new people, and this semester is no different. So we'll begin with a quick introduction, and then move on to our topic for today. Anyone who enters Machon Meir, by the mere nature of this institution, is someone who has had a lot of courage and has decided to add a lot of content to their life and learn about Judaism, about their heritage, about how to be a good Jew. When one makes a change in life, one runs the risk of being imbalanced. Every change causes an imbalance. The greater the change, the greater the imbalance. Even when the change that one makes is right, one still has the danger of being imbalanced. One of the places where this shows up the most is when a person who does gerut, or a person who does tshuva, is faced with the challenge of building a good Jewish home. And most people will ultimately fall back to the prototype of what they saw at home. That's the home we are most familiar with. For better, or for even better, we are familiar with what we saw at home. When one has made such a change, so one tries to make his home different. One wants to build a good Jewish home, and one wants his home to be better than what he saw. And when one doesn't have a prototype to fall back on, then one is faced with Herculean feat and something which is going to challenge one throughout one's life. The best thing that you can do is visit other Jewish homes, good Jewish homes, homes of people who grew up in Jewish homes, and the more homes you see, the more you'll have a picture of how your home should look or how you want your home to look. Don't look for the weird homes. Don't look for the homes that do things in an unusual way. Look for the classical homes. I recommend that any Shabbos that you can and any meal that you can, you go to someone to see someone's house. We had a student here not so long ago who really knew his stuff. He knew the lingo. I didn't know that he was only 3 years keeping kosher and keeping mitzvot. I thought he was born to a religious household. And after leaving the Machon, we met. He once needed a letter of recommendation from me. And I'm happy to give it. So, as we were talking, I told him, look, I don't know your history. I never asked you for your history, so tell me. And then he told me. And I told him, nah, you're kidding. I don't believe it. And he said, no, I'm serious. So I said, how'd you get to know so much if you're only doing this for 3 years? So he told me, well, what do you mean? I did what you always say. I frequented Jewish homes. And that's how I got to know my stuff. And I'm telling you, this guy knew his stuff. It was amazing. He sat here, you could have sworn, I could have sworn, he grew up in a Jewish home. And he came from a home where he didn't know right from left. He didn't know anything. But he made sure before he came to the Machon already, he was going to people's homes, and that's how he learned. And that's why I say and I say again, as much as you can, go to other people's homes. It doesn't have to be teachers in the Machon. I prefer homes that are based, not homes of people who learned in the Machon. But even that is good. I don't encourage meals at the Machon. And the Machon has an in Shabbos, so they'll still let you get away with going one of the meals to one of the Ramim, one of the Rabbeim, or someone in the neighborhood. Go. And bug Yoshua and bug Rav Listman, bug Gil Efrati, whoever it takes, get yourself invited out. In the past, almost every Shabbos we had at least one meal. We had guys from the Machon, and sometimes two or three meals. Now the situation is such that I'm not home at all myself. I have a child in the hospital. Bezrat Hashem, things will return to normalcy shortly. And then again, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to be happy to have you guys over. But I'm one house. Every house has its advantages and its disadvantages. The things you should learn from, things you shouldn't learn from. You have to see many homes and see what resonates with you. But that's the best education you can get. We started this class to try and fill in whatever gaps we can. And basically we're going to discuss all kinds of basic concepts to any home, and these are concepts which are especially important in a Jewish home. We all have different needs. We have our basic physical needs. We have to eat, drink, sleep. And then we have emotional needs. One of the emotional needs that most people spend their lives yearning to fill is the need to feel appreciated. After speaking to many women who ran away from home, there was a census which came to the conclusion that well over 50% of the women left their marriages and left their homes because they felt they weren't appreciated. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rabbi, had a baby girl. And he went out to the streets, and one of the Jerusalem rabbis met him, one of the Babylonian rabbis, Rabbi Chiya, met him, and he complimented him. He said, "It's so great that you have a daughter. A daughter will bring fruitfulness, she'll bring the continuation of humanity. You've merited that you've had a baby girl." And Rabbi Shimon came up all smiles to his father, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. And when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi saw him, he told him, "The Babylonian made you happy, huh? Told you good stuff." So he said, "Yeah, he told me it's a good thing that I had a girl. He told me that's the continuation of humanity. I hereby have a daughter, and she represents continuum." So Rebbe told him, "It's nice what he told you. Bottom line, the world needs tanners, and the world needs people who deal with perfume. Praised is a person that deals with perfume, loved is a person that deals with tanneries. Praised is a person if a person has a son, or woe to a person if he has a daughter." So Rabbi Shimon wasn't so happy. So the commentators ask, "What is Rabbi saying? We know the Torah commands us, we're supposed to procreate. And part of the commandment of procreation is you're supposed to have a son and a daughter. Now what's so bad about having a daughter?" So the Gra gives us insight to what Rabbi was saying. And in this insight, with this insight, we can begin to understand the difficulties of being a woman. Rebbe wasn't coming to degrade women. The Gra explains to us with the following insight. Say you're on a desert island and you're out of clothes. Just landed, shipwrecked on an island. What's the first thing you want to get? You want to get some clothing. You got to get shoes on your feet so you could travel. The halacha says in Shulchan Aruch, every person is supposed to have shoes on his feet. Make sure you have shoes. You need to deal with tannery. You need to deal with hides. Everyone needs shoes. You're not thinking about perfume when you're stuck on a desert island. People can manage without perfume. People cannot manage without hides. They cannot manage without shoes. They cannot manage without a tanner. What Rebbe was telling Rabbi Shimon, his son, was, praised is one who has a son. That doesn't mean he is better off. That means that is what will be praised. Everyone looks at the guy dealing with perfume and they praise him. Oh, it's fun going into his shop. But when push comes to shove and you're out of money, you don't go buy perfume. You go buy hides. You go buy shoes. Shoes are far more fundamental to humanity than perfume. Rebbe was telling Rabbi Shimon, you should know, a daughter is not praised. It's like the shoes you wear. Everything a girl does, everything a wife does, people don't appreciate. She cooks supper, you eat it, you say it was delicious, and it's finished. The husband, he has a job, he's a lawyer, he's making a mint, everyone looks up at him. Look at him, he's a lawyer, he's a doctor, he's a rabbi. Everyone looks at him and says, wow. No one thinks about the woman that's taking care of the kids at home, putting them to sleep, dealing with the laundry, dealing with the bills, dealing with whatever she's dealing with, because that's stuff like the shoes we wear. We step on them. We need them. They are the must in life. But we step on them, and we don't appreciate them, and we don't appreciate the man who makes them. We appreciate the one who makes the perfume. When one has a son, praised is the one who has a son, like one who owns a perfume shop. It's praise. people praise him, but it's not necessity. The daughter, that's necessity. She's the continuum. But by the same token that she's the necessity, she's the one that doesn't get appreciation. She's the one that's doing the jobs which she always has to do all over again. We live in a generation where people are exceptionally weak at expressing appreciation. Maybe it stems from the fact that we're so self-centered. And part of showing appreciation is, I need you. I appreciate what you did. You are good. You. The focus is you. When we write in English, we capitalize the I and we lowercase the you. And appreciation makes the you capital and the I a lowercase. We don't like that. Appreciation is central to relationship. It's central to a relationship with the chavrusa, and it's central to a relationship with a spouse or a roommate. I often stop a chavrusa and tell them, I don't know how you feel about this chavrusa, but I want to tell you, I really enjoy learning with you. I really get a lot from this, and I'm really enjoying it. And I see them squirming in their seats, like they don't know what to do themselves. What's so bad? I told them the truth. I enjoy learning with him. But we live in a world where we're not accustomed to giving appreciation, and we're not accustomed to getting appreciation. Both. That's why you'll find that sometimes you tell someone a compliment, and the first thing they do is they knock the compliment. And you think to yourself, why'd you do that? I just said something nice to you. Why'd you make fun of it? And the reason is because people don't know what to do with it.
Maybe it's humbleness.
Maybe.
So what do you do with it?
You could say thank you. I was once... I'll give you an example. And this will give us a little bit more insight. A husband comes home and he tells his wife, it's amazing. How'd you manage to clean up the house so well? And she says, oh, it's nothing. What does she mean to say? If you really mean it, you'll argue. You'll say, yeah, it's something. What do you mean? It's not only a wife. A roommate is that way too. We're all that way. Sometimes, when we knock the compliment, we want the other side to disagree. So if someone comes home and the first time says, you know, the lunch you made me was amazing. And the wife says, oh, it was nothing. Says, okay. The next day comes home and he says, thanks, lunch was really, really good. And she says, I told you it was nothing. So by the third day he says, okay, I won't say anything. That's not good. That's not good. After a few weeks, she's going to say, hey, buddy, you want lunch? I want to hear something. And he's going to say, well, I thought you said it was nothing. And she's going to say, yeah, I said that, but you can't say that. It's true. The problem is that this is all in story form. In real life, we're not as expressive and we don't even define to ourselves what's bothering us. We live with constant needs for appreciation. A wife especially needs appreciation because she's doing all the thankless jobs. And a wife could spend all day cleaning the house and doing the laundry and doing the shopping, and a week later, the laundry has to be done again. The shopping has to be done again. She has to cook and clean again. What's left? What's she got to show for it? It's not uncommon that women will reach the age of 40, 45, when the kids are out of the house, and they look back at all the time they brought up their kids, and they have wonderful, successful kids, and they start thinking to themselves, what have I done with my life? So I've cooked and I've cleaned and my kids came out okay. But you know what? A lot of women who have careers, their kids also came out okay. And it's very hard for a woman to look back and say, wait a second, my kids are balanced individuals. I gave them the care. I was there for them. I helped them out. Because at the end of the day, what's she got to show for it? It's very hard. We as children and we as spouses have a responsibility to show appreciation. And it's not to be saved for Mother's Day. It's every day. I mean, if you're here today, a good part of it is what your parents taught you. I forgot. I usually start our Navi class with a thank you to my mother. Because when I was a little kid, my mother used to read me as bedtime stories, the stories from Tanakh. I started learning Tanakh when I was 4 or 5 years old with bedtime stories. So I always tell my mother, I send her copies of my classes and I say, this is your work. So I'm just continuing what you taught me. But the truth is that all of us are continuing what we were taught. We're building on what we were taught. I was once going hiking, and as I'm about to enter the path, I pass by a person's house, and he sees me with my food and drink, and he tells me, you ain't gonna pollute here, buddy, right? So I looked at him, and I was about to say, I ain't gonna walk here, buddy. I'm out of here. So I said, no, why would I? So he said, well, I see you got food and bags, and you'll have leftovers. So I said, yeah, I'll put it in my bag, and I'll take it out with me. So he said, okay, that's the way it should be. So I said, yeah, right. So he said, why are you looking at me like it's obvious? You know how many people come here and pollute? I live right next to here. Every week I got to clean up what other people pollute. And then he ended with a line that stayed with me to this day. It all comes down to what your mother taught you. It does. We had PTA this week. So my son was 3 and a half. So you ask yourself, what are they going to tell you at 3 and a half PTA? You know, that the teacher had a lot of interesting things to say. And one of the things she said she's a marriage counselor, and she's encountering all kinds of issues in the home, and the issues are really that people don't know how to share, they don't know how to give. So she said, we have to get our kids accustomed to giving. When she gives out candies, she'll hide a few, and she'll be about to give out all the candies, and she'll say, uh-oh, I'm missing a few candies. Who wants to ensure that someone else won't be sad? And then she'll miraculously find some candies. But first she wants to get kids used to sharing with one another. That one kid's going to say, no, I want to do the mitzvah. I want the other kids not to feel sad. Well, our parents trained us with many things. And we have to show them appreciation. We also have to show our spouses appreciation. There are two not so similar concepts that are sometimes confused. Commiseration and appreciation. They're both important. But sometimes people confuse them. And when we confuse them, we feel like we've done our part and in fact we've cheated the other side. When we commiserate, we're showing that we care, we're sympathizing, we're empathizing. But part of commiseration is the focus on ourselves and the focus on the difficulty the other person is having. And here, you guys could look at the sheets I put together. And the first example is one person sees a spouse, or the same thing is true for a child, who's working very hard, and he could say, I'm sorry you're working so hard. Now that sounds like a very fair statement. Why not say you're sorry they're working so hard? But if you're really sorry they're working so hard, so get up there and help them. What does it mean you're sorry they're working so hard? If your spouse is doing the laundry and washing the floor and doing the dishes and doing the cooking and doing the shopping and you're really sorry, so why don't you do something about it? What are you sorry for? If it's legitimate that you're not doing it, so fine. At the end, you'll see there's an addendum that discusses the sentence, the clause, I'm sorry, and that different people and different parts of society define those words differently. But sometimes we have to know that our job is not to say, I'm sorry, this is what's happening, but rather to show appreciation. You're doing so much, that's amazing. I really appreciate how much you're doing. Notice, what did I do? I gave a positive. I showed appreciation. When I said, I am sorry, I don't want to call it a negative, but I automatically am referring to a difficulty. I automatically am focusing on the negativity, on what's difficult about it. It's important to commiserate. There are situations where we have to commiserate. But when what we're supposed to show is appreciation, we have to recognize that to commiserate is not to show appreciation. The two cannot be confused. One of the things that people find difficult, be it to their spouse or their child, is to show appreciation. And you'll see many children waiting and yearning for appreciation. And for some reason, this is especially true in our generation, people find it difficult to tell a kid, you're great, that's wonderful. There were parents I met with whose child was misbehaving. And I asked them to sit with the child, and I had no issues with the child. And then I sat with them when they were with the child, and I saw they're constantly telling the kids, no, you can't do that. Don't do this, don't do that. And when I walked into the room, the first thing I did was put a hand on the kid's shoulder. I sat down and spoke with him. I marveled at how brilliant he was. I showed him appreciation. And what bothered me was that even after I pointed this out to them, they couldn't do it. They said, yeah, you're right, but they couldn't do it. I said, did you try when the kid walks home to go over, give him a hug and a kiss and tell him, you know, I missed you. I'm so happy you came home. The house is empty without you. Something positive. No. The first thing you'll hear is, I'm sorry you had a rough day in school. What do? We commiserate it. It's much easier to commiserate, because what am I doing when I'm commiserating? I'm okay. You have the problem. So I'm showing sympathy for your problem. What am I doing when I show appreciation? You're okay. You're great. And I'm going to appreciate who you are. That's more difficult. I have to pick you up when I show appreciation. And for some reason, there's this illness where parents have a hard time even doing it to their own kids. Chazal tells us that a normal parent wants only better for his child. The parent isn't jealous of his child. He wants his child to be better than he himself was. Well, if that's so, it shouldn't be difficult to show appreciation. And appreciation is for the little things. It's very easy to take for granted that my wife's making supper. What do you mean? I'm out there working all day. I'm bringing home the paycheck. Of course, that's her end of the deal. That's her job. It's very easy to take down appreciation. We say in davening, modim anachnu lach. We thank you, God. So the Taz discusses, what does the word modem mean? The word modem in Hebrew has a dual meaning. The word modem means I admit. The word modem means I thank. And the Taz says they're one and the same. Whenever you're saying thank you, you're admitting that you need the other side. So when we say modim anachnu lach, when we're thanking God, we are also saying, we are admitting that we need you. We're admitting that you did something for us we couldn't have done without you. That's part and parcel with saying thank you. Today's society has seen an advent of inflated egos. Inflated, but not really healthy. That's why teachers today will encounter more and more children, not 5 years old, not 7 years old, but I saw this 10 years ago with eighth graders, that you tell them, why not say thank you to the bus driver when you get off the bus? Get off the front door and tell him thank you. And they turn to you and they say, why? That's his job. He's getting paid for it.
I do it every time with the bus driver, but he's also looking at me like, why are you saying?
Yeah, that's true. I got on a bus one morning and I told the driver, good morning. Yeah. And he said, that's the nicest thing I heard today. Isn't that sad? Isn't that sad?
Thank you for the bus.
Okay. So
well, I found Israel, since I moved to Israel, it's like nobody says thank you. And people even are hesitant when you say thank you, and Tada Rabah, they go, in Badna. Like they kind of mumble it, you know.
Right. Even in Badna. Yeah. In Badna, there's
what's
nothing
that? Don't
for.
Step over there and say it.
Right. Okay. So I think this is where we have to recognize that us who come from Chutzaretz have things to impart upon Israeli societies. There are good things in Chutzaretz, not only bad. Yeah.
When you know better Hebrew,
you'll say lo tzich el taya lo ma toda rava. It doesn't have to be a problem to say thank you.
I know this might sound naive to me, but being a Jewish country and, you know, steeped in Torah and, you know, building justice and taking care of people, you think people would be more egalitarian and more nice to, but I've seen people just like push old ladies trying to get out of the way, get on the bus and stuff.
So Rabbi Wein has
ladies pushing me out of the way to get on the bus, you know.
Rabbi Wein has an important line. He says, don't confuse Jews with Judaism.
Yeah.
Judaism is the ideal. Jews are supposed to strive for the ideal.
What did you say?
Don't confuse.
No, after that.
Judaism is the ideal. That's the way we're supposed to live.
Yeah.
Jews are supposed to aspire to the ideal and live according to it.
Once.
let's take a few of the examples that are written towards the bottom of the first page. A person can say, you have gone through such difficult times. Or, I admire your perseverance and resolve to make things work in spite of life's complexities. Notice that in the first sentence, the focus is you, difficulty. You, down there. I, commiserate. I'm giving you sympathy. But you are down. In the second one, where you show appreciation, you're automatically saying, I admire, I am putting you up, and you're strengthening the person. This happens to be one that I personally experienced the last few weeks. A lot of people offered sympathy, and it just like drained me. What are you offering me sympathy for? Okay. Help me out. Or don't help me out, but this certainly isn't helping. I'm sorry you had to study so hard for this test. Are you really sorry? I am sorry. Or, you really stood up to the challenge and put in great work. Now, obviously these words aren't words that we use in day-to-day language. I'm not saying you should stand there and say these words to your kids. It'll sound fake to them and probably to you too. So, these are just examples. You'll have to figure out how to word it yourself. I wish I could be there for you. Or, I have high regard. I admire the fact that you'll be able to do it without me. You know I wish I could be there. So there the I wish I could be there is just an adjunct. Whereas in the first one it's just I wish I could, but I can't. I'm sorry. Right? There's a totally different tone. And the last one, I'm sorry I wasn't able to make it to help you set it up. I'll try to make it up to you. Again, sorry. Sad. Whereas, I really appreciate it, you're going to be able to set it up without me. I'm going to try to make it up to you. Which is the same thought, but being given with a positive connotation. Now, you should just know that this isn't only reflective of how damaging commiseration can sometimes be for the recipient as opposed to admiration. It can also define the position that we're in. Sometimes when we apologize, we're automatically indicating that we did something wrong. And sometimes we did nothing wrong. It can't be any other way. Whereas when we show appreciation, we're saying, yeah, this is a difficult situation and I appreciate what you're doing. I owe you appreciation. I don't owe you an apology necessarily. Could be I couldn't have done anything different. The second I apologize, I'm setting up the scene like I did something wrong. So I'm skimping the appreciation that I owe. And I'm taking the downfall, so to speak. I'm saying I was wrong, which is sometimes a very easy way to go, but it's doing two harms. It's both blaming me for something that couldn't be different and skimming the other side of appreciation. I was once dating a girl, and after quite a number of dates, I realized it wasn't it. And she had a bunch of tests coming up, and it was like a Thursday afternoon, and I decided, okay, I realize that's not it, we're not going to get married. So, maybe I realized this like on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and I called up my rabbi and I said, look, I could set up a date with her for Thursday night. I can't break up like over the phone after such a long contact, but it'll ruin her Shabbos. And I could do it Matzah Shabbos or Sunday, but who knows, maybe someone will want to set her up with the guy who's supposed to be her husband and I'm delaying her when I know this isn't going to be it. So he told me, no, you owe it to her to break up now, as difficult as it's going to be for her to go into Shabbos this way. That's what you should do. So we come to the date and we talk, and I tell her, look, I really think that this isn't going to work. And I had called all the cousins, all the female cousins I had, and I asked them, am I wasting her time by calling her to a date? Should I do it by phone? Or is it more respectful to do it face to face? What's nicer to her? I don't know. I said, for me, it's easier to do it by phone. But tell me, you're a girl. So I called all my cousins, and the consensus was, it's chutzpah to do it by phone after such a number of dates. Do it face to face. Fine. So we come to the end of the date, and I tell her, and she gets upset. You called me out for this? You couldn't do it by phone? What'd you do this for? What'd you waste my time for? I can't believe you did it to me. So I was faced with two choices then. I could apologize. I could say, look, I'm sorry you feel bad, but you should know I did the best I could. I called whoever I could to try and find out what would be best for you. I couldn't have done better, and I told her, look, and that's what I did. I said, look, I don't know. I could have waited 2 days. I could have waited till after Yom Tov, Shabbos, whatever was coming up. But maybe your husband's waiting around the corner. Is it right that I should delay you? I realized it wasn't it, but I thought this was the best for you. I'm sorry it hurt you, but I really did the best I could. And when I said it that way, she stopped, and she apologized. And she said, you know what? You're right. I'm sorry. And just so happens, she married the next guy, and they did set her up right afterwards. Just like as an adjunct. That did happen. Today she's, I hope, happily married. I don't know. But she got married long before me. She got married to the next guy, and I'm happy I ended it that way. But sometimes we're put in a situation where we have two choices. And the easy way out is to say, I'm sorry. But it's not always the right way out. And sometimes we can frame the situation. We define whether the situation is going to be one where we're apologetic, or the situation is going to be one where we're saying, I have appreciation, and I want to show that appreciation. And there is an aspect where I'm sorry, but I'm doing the best I can, or you're doing the best you can. We should try to frame things as positive when that's the right way it should be. Of course, if we're wrong, then we should take responsibility and say, I'm sorry.
Sometimes though, with women, I found out no matter what you do, you're always going to be wrong.
Notice the words that we stress when we commiserate. You, difficult, I'm sorry, I wish. There's a thread of sorrow, regret, even a certain distress. That will, the second you're commiserating, that's part of the conversation. Of course, sometimes that's what's right. And when we show appreciation, there's something positive. The rest you guys can read. I want to end with two stories. There was a couple who moved to Israel. They got engaged, and they made their engagement party in the husband's community in the United States. They flew to the parents, they made the engagement party there, and a lot of people turned out because they wouldn't turn out to the wedding because the wedding was in Israel. So they came to the engagement party out in the United States, and they gave gifts because they knew they wouldn't be at the wedding. And this couple decided that they're not going to do the easy way out of sending thank you cards, thank you very much for your gift, we really appreciate it, may you be well. Being that really they're moving to Israel, they decided they're going to sit down and write thank you cards. With each person, they're going to add a personal note to the card. So one person they wrote to, I've always admired the way you brought up your kids. It's one of the things I'm going to take with me as I move to Israel. May you continue having a lot of nachas from your family. And another person they wrote to, your chazanut, the way you sang and brought in Rosh Chodesh always livened up my Rosh Chodesh. And it's one of the things I'll always remember beautifully about this community. And each person they sent a letter to, they added two or three sentences of appreciation. They flew back to Israel, and the phone calls started pouring in. Person after person, I know the people, this is a true story, started driving up to the parents' home and showing them a thank you card. Look what your son wrote me. Look, isn't this amazing? People actually framed those thank you cards and hung them up in their home. This one about his chazanut, and each one thought they themselves got it. They didn't realize the other one got it. People are yearning for appreciation. How often does a person get a letter saying, you know, your chazanut was beautiful, that's what made my Rosh Chodesh. The way you davened on Rosh Hashanah, that's what I'll remember for life. You write someone a letter like that, the person is singing. The person is singing so much that I'll hang it up, that it's hanging in their home to this day. The last point, I think, that's worth thinking about is these three words, I'm sorry. I am sorry. In some places, when we say I'm sorry, it's not a way of taking blame, but rather it's a way of commiserating, showing I'm sorry that you're in this predicament, that this situation is such. In other places, when the only time you say I'm sorry is when you have to be what to be sorry about. If you did something wrong, you say I'm sorry. And if you didn't, you don't. So imagine a person is shopping around in a store, and suddenly, bash, something breaks. And the store owner comes running in the back with a broken vase and he says, "Who did this?" And one of the people says, "Oh, I'm so sorry." So you can understand. He means, you know, "I'm sorry this happened to you." And the guy says, "You're going to pay? What do you mean you're sorry? Why should I pay? Just because I'm sorry for you, I should pay?" This sounds funny, but it's not so funny. There was a guy here at the Mahon that once told me, "I don't understand why people think that they can just step all over me. Why do people always think that I'm a pushover? Just because I say I'm sorry?" So I told him, "Yeah, because you say you're sorry all the time. You're taking the blame." So he said, "What do you mean I'm taking the blame? I show people that I care. They tell me something bad happened. I say I'm sorry. And then they start blaming me for it." So I explained to him this difference. It's an important difference to realize because it could also have an effect on the way we speak to people. You show up to a job interview and the guy says, "Why'd you walk in unannounced?" And you say, "I'm sorry," that automatically indicates you did something wrong. If you say, "Well, the secretary told me to walk in, I'm sorry it wasn't convenient," then you've explained, "I'm sorry it wasn't convenient for you, but I did nothing wrong, the secretary told me to walk in." Now the interview can go normally. If all you say is, "I'm sorry," then what you've said is, "I'm sorry," and the other side reads it as, "I'm sorry, you did something wrong." And this is true for shidduchim, this is true for job interviews, and it's also true in relationships between spouses and parents and children. I know a father that whatever goes wrong, he says, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And the kids are always looking like, "Why is he sorry?" And some of the kids have adopted that feeling of guilt, that whatever goes wrong, they think they're responsible because the father always said, "I'm sorry," and they misinterpreted it. So obviously that's an extreme example, but it's something to think about if you're one of those people that constantly say, "I'm sorry," and what you mean is, "I'm sorry that this is your predicament." It might be a habit worth breaking because in today's day and age, most people interpret it as taking blame. So, we're going to stop here.